Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now to a man with quite a story. He embraced Christian faith in his late teens, and yet for many years, if you looked into his heart, you would see a racist. And then Rory Steyn met Nelson Mandela. More than that, for 3.5 years, he was as close as you could get to one of the world's most significant figures of this past century. Rory once regarded Nelson Mandela as a terrorist, but in the post-apartheid era, he found himself suddenly living and working literally one step behind this great man as his human shield, the president's bodyguard. And there began a powerful personal transformation in Rory Steyn that mirrored the spirit of forgiveness and reconciliation that took place at a national level in South Africa. It's a wonderful story with intimate personal glimpses of the man, Mandela, who went from prison to president and quite literally saved his nation. Rory, welcome to Open House.
You're very welcome.
It's a great privilege to meet you. Thank you. Rory, can you give us an insight into your life and your heart as you lived life as a white man through the apartheid era, and how you viewed the black population and their campaign against apartheid?
You know, Lee, it's very difficult, I believe, for somebody who's not South African and who didn't grow up when I grew up to understand this. So I'll do my best. Yeah. The South Africa that I grew up in was a completely segregated one, and it was, secondly, one that was dominated by the ideology of apartheid, which meant that the school curricula, the media, even the church was inculcated with this ideology. So we grew up going to schools where there were only white kids. And the crazy thing is, all South African kids grow up with a domestic worker in our homes who's normally a black lady. They're normally wonderful people. The point is that these ladies become like second mothers to our children. Yes. And then you play with their kids in the home and in the garden, and then all of a sudden 6 years of age comes and you go to this school and they go to that school, and you think that's pretty normal.
How did you view black people, apart from the domestic help?
We accepted from a very early age that, you know, black people shouldn't have the same opportunities as we have, you know, for no other reason than just because they're black. Crazy it sounds now, 18 years down the, you know, down the line, but yes, that's the way we thought. And when I went to the police, remember that the police now become the enforcers of all laws. We were the enforcers of the apartheid laws. So we would go out. Shifts at a police station would have competitions to see who could make the most number of arrests in a month, and then the station commander would give you a day off. The easiest way to do that was go and arrest black people who weren't carrying their passes to be in the white areas.
How did you view Nelson Mandela as he was serving his 27 years in prison?
I'm almost ashamed to say that from this very mouth came the words that they should have hanged him at the time that he was tried. Like most uninformed young white kids are, they should have just hanged the whole lot of them at the time of the treason trial. It was called the treason trial. And I'm ashamed of that today, but that's how I thought.
Did you ever feel the conflict with your Christian faith?
Because funnily enough, no. The only way that I can explain that is, both as a Christian and as a cop, there's right and there's wrong. And if you do something that takes another person's life, well, then your life should be given. So I didn't see any conflict with that at all. I think I'm a little more mature, probably and hopefully a little wiser. I probably wouldn't have said what I said had I understood now what I do.
You initially trained to work as a policeman for the South African Police Force, a force we now know was responsible for some really bad things, and you would know that.
Yes.
To hold the line against those who opposed apartheid.
Exactly. And I was recruited by the special branch, or the security police, the dreaded security police that were responsible for a lot of bad stuff. Yeah. When you think about the very famous beatings in detention and subsequent deaths even, like the likes of Steve Biko, it was the special branch or the security police that were responsible for that. How's this for an irony? Precisely because I was a Christian. Because one of the suspects that the security police monitored was the South African Council of Churches, because they were quite a subversive organization. In fact, they probably were the internal wing of the ANC, because they received a lot of donor funding that kept the kind of activities of the ANC going. So we would monitor them. And because I was a Christian, I was recruited into the security police. How weird is that?
Can you take us to your encounter with Mandela on Inauguration Day when he's made president, and with your own personal history, how you'd viewed the man?
Brilliant question. 10th of May rolls around, and the president is due to go to Ellis Park And the idea behind him going to Ellis Park on Inauguration Day was precisely because they were expecting massive crowds at the Union Buildings to celebrate the inauguration, and there were massive crowds there. So the thinking is, let's get 60,000 fewer people to go pouring up the highway from Joburg to Pretoria. Let's put them into Ellis Park, televise the inauguration on the big screen live, and then play a soccer match between South Africa and another country. It turned out that it was Zambia. And the idea was the president would be inaugurated at the Union Buildings. Then all his guests, and there were many of them, 184 heads of state, people that we'd never seen in South Africa before, people that were demonized in my day as a cop. I'm talking of the likes of Gaddafi, Arafat, Fidel Castro, for heaven's sake, Mugabe, coming to South Africa. And they all had to move from the Union Buildings about a K down the road to the lawns of the presidential guest house where they would be served lunch. So he only gets there at half time because he says, I've got to get back and host this lunch, man. So now they're about to drive away to go back to the chopper. And we see the president trying to open the door of this 4-ton armored car. So they open the door. President gets out, doesn't say a word to any of us. He just starts walking across the floor towards the vehicle ramp where the vehicle is supposed to drive out to go to the helicopter. And the only person that's there is this old school police colonel in full uniform, a real old South African police colonel.
A white man.
A white man. And he's been there and done it all and seen it all. You know, he's about mid-50s, lines on the dial. You can see this guy's been around the bush more than once. And as the president walks towards him, his eyes are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And he's thinking, why is he coming to me? And the president still hasn't said a word. And he walks up to the guy, stops in front of him, puts out his hand, says to him, Colonel, I just want to tell you that today you have become our police. He said, I'm now the president of this country. And I want you to know personally from my mouth that there's no more you and us. You are now our police. And Lee, this old man started crying. And the tears were running down those lines on his face, and they were dripping like this onto the polished wooden parquet flooring in this reception hall.
You took a time to be convinced of his rhetoric
right.
of reconciliation, didn't you?
And that's the point here. Yeah. Because when he was released 4 years ago, and he came out of jail, and he stood on the Grand Parade on the day he was released, he made a speech on the Grand Parade in Cape Town, packed. And he said, quoting from the Freedom Charter, South Africa is for all her people, both black and white. And I was going, yeah, right. You're supposed to say that, man. That's the ANC party line. It's rhetoric. You're going to say that. And I did not believe him. And the day that this happened, it was witnessed by no more than 10 or 12 of us. There were no media there. It wasn't a media opportunity. Now, just think about this, Lee. Mm. He's got 184 of the most important people in the world waiting for him at lunch. And they can blooming well wait. Because I've got to go and tell that colonel this. And that was the day. I was 32 years old at the time, I reckon. So I'd had a lifetime's worth of conditioning inputted into me. And that's the day I started to question it. I said, no, man, this cannot be a facade. And there's got to be something to this. If there's that level of forgiveness from this man who we incarcerated for 27 years, maybe I must just rethink this whole thing. And I did. I started to rethink all that stuff that I had considered as normal.
Is there another moment that you can relate to us of that grace, that forgiveness and reconciliation, which he embodied?
There is, and there are many such examples. Sure. I mean, I saw, please understand this, that I do appreciate how privileged I was to see this man change our nation and change me. Up close and personal, I saw it. I mean, I was right there. And there's another great story of a visiting head of state. He happened to be the president of Ghana, who came to South Africa on a state visit. So the president walks down the staircase and he stands at the bottom of the staircase. There are three semicircular stairs that go down onto the roadway. And he stands at the top of these stairs. The visiting head of state's motorcade pulls up and there are no bodyguards in black suits and dark glasses who jump out and make the whole scene untidy. It's a formal thing. There's a colonel with a full dress uniform, ribbons and medals, and white gloves, and he opens the door of the president's car. That president gets out of it, walks up the stairs, and stands shoulder to shoulder with our president, facing the guard of honor that's drawn up on the other side of the red carpet in the roadway. The motorcade drives away. The band plays the national anthems. of both countries. Then the commander of the Guard of Honor walks up to the two presidents, salutes them with his saber, and invites the visiting head of state to inspect his Guard of Honor. And this is normal in any country. So President Rawlings goes down, and he walks up and down the red carpet along the front rank of the Guard of Honor. I am standing behind a pillar that's holding up this roofway that comes down the cascading stairs. I can just see the president's back. It's about an arm and a half's length from where I'm standing behind the pillar. President Rawlings' duty returns, and as the two presidents turn to go up the staircase, the whole cabinet of the government of the Republic of South Africa are standing and waiting on the stairs, and our president introduces his guest to each cabinet minister, and they go. And instead of going up the stairs, President Mandela says to his chief of protocol in Afrikaans, because he was a white Afrikaner, old John Reinders, he says, John, roep die kind. He says, call that child, and he points like this. And John looks at me behind the pillar, and I shrug my shoulders, thinking, I don't know. John says, excuse me, Mr. President? And Madiba says, call that child. And he points, and true as nuts, at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning at the Union Buildings is a little kid, 10 years old, in his school uniform, a little khaki short safari suit with his long socks and his polished shoes, and he's at the Union Buildings instead of sitting in the classroom somewhere. How he got there or why he was there, none of us had any idea. But John thought, well, if the president wants the child, I better go call the child. Yeah. So John goes down the stairs, across the red carpet, through the soldiers, he calls the boy. The boy comes through the soldiers, across the red carpet, climbs up onto the stairs, and he's standing between these two presidents. And Madiba bends down and he asks the kid his name. And then he turns and he indicates President Rawlings, and he says to the child, well, this is President Rawlings of Ghana. Introduces this little boy standing there bewildered. Yeah. And, you know, that's the time that I started chomping on the lump that was in my throat because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And Lee, it was more than just a black president calling this little white kid across to introduce him to another black president. You know, and I can see what was going on in Madiba's head because he's standing on the stairs now waiting for his guest to finish walking up and down the front rank of the Guard of Honor. And he must have spied this child there and he thought, what is he doing here?
Yeah.
And he thought, well, let me ask him. And by the way, the cabinet can wait for me to introduce the president to them. I'm going to find out what this little boy is doing here. And it's a formal occasion, but that can wait because it's an opportunity to show both the boy and his guest. Black and whites in South Africa, we're supposed to be one nation now. And to this day, I don't know what he was doing there, mate, but his mother saw him on the 6 o'clock news, the 7 o'clock news, and the 8 o'clock news.
It's a new day.
Yeah.
Rory, how did this truly privileged experience for 3.5 years, how did it affect your faith?
I don't think I could have got through 3.5 years. That was, in essence, 5 full years of his presidency. I don't think I could have got through that time without my faith, because think of the responsibility that our teams had. And I was the team leader of just one of 4 teams. But think of the responsibility that we had. And we've got to keep this great icon of the world safe. When I think about it now, sometimes I go cold and I get goosebumps. And I can tell you that if it wasn't for my faith, you know, a job is a job. Yep. You're a media personality. Whether you're a media personality or a church pastor, or you're a presidential bodyguard, you got the same problems. You know, you get up in the morning and the wife's screaming at the kids to get ready for school, and it doesn't matter whether you wake up at home or in a hotel or in a bush somewhere next to the president's house in the countryside. Yeah. Your job is the same. Keep him alive until he goes to bed tonight. If ever his life was in danger, you know, I was prepared to give mine. Now, that I don't say lightly, Lee, and there's far too many people in my profession running around this, you know, with this cliched, oh, I'll take a bullet and all that. You don't say that lightly. Trust me, if you're in the game, you think not once, not twice, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times before you make that commitment. I'm just a cop who's been given the duty of looking after him. I would repay with a loyalty of my own that I would ensure that nothing ever happened to him. I don't think I could have done that without a strong faith, just saying every day, Lord, keep him safe, keep us safe, and help us to do our job.
Talk to us about what you've seen and experienced of the power of forgiveness and reconciliation.
Well, I don't believe, honestly, I don't believe that there has in history been a greater example of forgiveness than a man who was incarcerated by an oppressive government for 27 years, 19 of which were on Robben Island, and comes out without any bitterness, and with a, in fact, not only without bitterness, but with a specific and definite and well thought through agenda to stretch out this hand of reconciliation. The fact that he stood in front of that colonel on Inauguration Day and knew his rank means that he had made a study of what the rank structure was. And that's the kind of detail that he, you know, the kind of attention to detail that he paid. And he came out with this structured agenda that I am going to reach out to the Afrikaner. And that's why he put on that number 6 jersey of Francois Pinault's on that day. To my mind, that was the pinnacle, the highest point of his 5 years as president, was that one day, 24th of June 1995, no South African will ever forget it, he put on that jersey, and with that simple act, he brought on side 98% of the Afrikaners. That stadium was full of 60,000 rabid South African supporters. 95% of them were white. 70% of those whites were Afrikaners. And they started chanting his name. When he walked out of that tunnel, I remember pinching myself.
Yes.
I was sitting on the all-black bench, and this crowd of whites start chanting, "Nelson, Nelson." If you go and watch the video of that final, you can hear it. It's loud. In those days, we didn't know yet, as whites, we didn't know the name Madiba yet, which is the name that the blacks call him. It's indicative of the position he has within the Xhosa tribe, which is an advisor to the king, the Madiba clan. So now everybody, every South African, very affectionately refers to the great man as Madiba. But in those days, they chanted his first name, which is actually a little disrespectful. You don't just call somebody by their first name if you don't know him well enough. And these whites, rabid rugby fans, were chanting his name. It's absolutely incredible, only because he put on that jersey.
What an enormous privilege.
Yeah.
To be alongside
An that. Enormous privilege, yeah. What strikes me as I sit here is this, that as profound as the change was that President Mandela made in my own life, and I watched him make in our nation, and the marvelous examples of reconciliation that are recounted, those pale into insignificance when you compare that to the reconciliation that Jesus Christ brings, because it's an eternal reconciliation. He deals with everything in our lives, all the sin that prevents us from going to heaven and being with God one day. He sorts that out forever. You know, and we're all waiting for the day. One day, Madiba will be no more. It'll be the greatest media event the world has ever seen, I'm convinced. But that day is coming. But Jesus rose from the grave to buy us our freedom forever. And that's the great lesson here for me.
Rory Stone, it's been a great privilege meeting you and hearing your story. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Open House. Rory's here for a series of talks in Australia, and we'll put the details up on our Open House community Facebook page.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.